Good evening. Welcome to the first virtual meeting of the BC Electoral Boundaries Commission. I would like to acknowledge that I'm joining you today from the territories of the Tanaha Nation. We are grateful for their stewardship of these lands. My name is Linda Tynan. I am one of the commissioners and a local government advisor. Please allow me to introduce my fellow commissioners. Justice Nitsha Iyer of the Supreme Court of British Columbia, and Chair of the Electoral Boundaries Commission, joining us from the territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish peoples. And Anton Bogman, Commissioner, and British Columbia's Chief Electoral Officer, joining us from the territories of the Coast Salish peoples. Let me tell you about who we are and what we do before we get into the presentations. We are an independent and nonpartisan commission created by the Electoral Boundaries Commission Act. The Act requires commissions like ours to review electoral districts after every second provincial election. Our job is to review the area, boundaries, and names of electoral districts and make recommendations for change. The way we've chosen to do this is by first asking BC residents for their views on this topic. That is the purpose of today's meeting. After this first round of public consultations, we will publish a preliminary report with our initial recommendations. We hope to do that by early fall 2022. We will then have a second round of public meetings asking for input on the proposed changes. And then following that, we will write our final report and recommendations. It will also be public, of course, and our final report must be submitted by April 2023. Ultimately, the BC Legislative Assembly decides whether to accept all, some, or none of our recommendations. The Electoral Boundaries Commission Act explains what factors we must take into account when making recommendations. I'll tell you a little bit about those. Our governing principle is representation by population. In order to achieve representation by population, we must consider the following. Geographic factors such as accessibility and size, demographic factors such as population numbers, rate of growth, and communities of interest, and lastly, means of communication and transportation within the electoral district. We must try to ensure that each electoral district is within 25% of the population average of an electoral district, which is currently approximately 57,000, but we can exceed this range if we consider it necessary to achieve effective representation. There are currently 87 electoral districts in BC, and the Act allows us to propose up to 6 additional electoral districts for a maximum of 93. As mentioned at the start of the meeting, this is the first virtual meeting that we have conducted. Before getting started with our first presenter, I'll briefly outline the process for today. At this time, all meeting participants have been muted. If you did not register in advance, but would like to provide input at today's meeting, please click the raise hand button, which you'll see on your Zoom toolbar. This will signal the commission staff to add your name to the list of presenters for today's meeting. I will call each presenter by name. When your name is called, you will be invited to become a panelist, at which point you can unmute yourself and begin your presentation. The commissioners will be able to see presenters, so you may wish to have your video turned on for the presentation. Presentations at these public hearings or public meetings are recorded and the audio files will be available on the Commission website. If you have any questions about privacy, please review the privacy policy which is posted on the Commission's website. Your name and community will be listed with the recording. For consistency between all of our meetings, we ask you to limit your presentation to no longer than 10 minutes. After hearing from all the presenters, we will answer questions from meeting participants. You may post a question at any time during the meeting. If your question is of a technical nature, commission staff will respond immediately. If it is a general question regarding commission work, the commissioners will respond after hearing from all presenters. to ask a question, use that Q&A button that's also found on your Zoom toolbar. After any questions have been addressed, the meeting will close. And although you're doing this presentation and it'll be posted on the website, the audio, presenters are also encouraged to submit a copy of their presentation to the Commission website at www.bcebc.ca. The Commission is accepting public input and submissions to inform its preliminary report until 4:30 p.m. on Tuesday, May 31st, 2022. At this time, we have 13 presenters registered to speak. However, we may add a few more as the meeting continues and someone may decide that they would like to speak after all. So with that, we will now begin calling presenters. As I noted before, please ensure that your microphone is unmuted before you begin your presentation. We will get started with our first presenter, which will be Nathan Edelson. Oh, I'm sorry. Nathan has not arrived. We'll move to the second presenter, which is Dennis Pylon.
Well, thank you very much. It's Dennis Pylon. Just a slight detail there.
Thank you.
Sorry. Just making some adjustments here. Okay. Well, thank you very much for allowing me to make a presentation to the Commission today. I've timed my presentation. It runs at about 10 minutes, so I'm hoping I'll be right on time. So let me introduce myself. I'm currently an associate professor in the Department of Politics at York University in Toronto, focusing on Canadian and comparative politics with a research specialization in elections and BC politics. I know BC very well. I'm from BC originally. I was born in Vancouver, and growing up, I lived all over BC, places like Williams Lake, Wildwood, Maclise Lake in the central interior, Cassiar in the far north, Port McNeil on Vancouver Island, and nearly every suburb of Vancouver, as well as Vancouver's east side and west end. As an adult, I worked in a number of BC locales like Smithers and Victoria and Vancouver. My education was in BC. I have a BA and MA from Simon Fraser. And my first academic job was in the political science department at the University of Victoria. I also have practical experience running elections in BC, acting as a deputy district electoral officer in two provincial elections in downtown, in the downtown Vancouver Burrard constituency. In terms of my academic research, a considerable amount focuses on BC elections and politics. I am the co-editor of the most recent textbook on BC politics, and I've published a number of journal articles and book chapters on BC elections, its party system, class structure, and democratic reform processes. I appear before you today to address the question of voter equality and how I think the Commission should judge claims for departures from it, particularly claims made on the basis of an alleged need to overrepresent rural areas by maintaining significantly unequal levels of population between constituencies. And I will send my comments to the Commission. So just in case you're scrambling to write things down, I will provide you with a print copy of all of this. So claims of a need to overrepresent BC's rural areas tend to comprise three points. The three points are these. Number one, rural areas have unique economic and social needs. Two, rural areas face unique geographic challenges in terms of their representation. And three, rural areas risk being overwhelmed by the voting power of more densely populated urban areas, particularly BC's lower mainland. Now, the relevant Canadian jurisprudence on this question has suggested that such concerns as those presented above can be taken into consideration in the design of electoral boundaries. Justice Beverly McLaughlin, writing for the majority position in the 1991 reference case on Saskatchewan's provincial boundaries, suggested that factors like geography, community history, community interests, and minority representation could be brought to bear to create what she called effective representation and justify departures from strict voter equality in terms of the number of electors per constituency. However, in a qualification clearly meant to circumscribe the application of such exceptions, McLaughlin argued, and I quote, that only those deviations should be admitted which can be justified on the ground that they contribute to better government of the populace as a whole, giving due weight to regional issues within the populace and geographic factors within the territory governed. Now, the two key terms in the judgment, in my view, are justified and due weight. In the same judgment, the Supreme Court affirmed that voter equality, understood as voter parity between constituencies, was, quote, of prime importance, unquote, and that where departures from voter equality could not be justified by recourse to other concerns, then, quote, the dilution of one citizen's vote as compared with another should not be countenanced, unquote. So that brings us to the question of, well, just how would claims for departures from voter equality be justified in concrete terms? Or to use our specific example, how do people defend the idea that overrepresenting rural areas is an appropriate way to give them their due weight? Now, let me begin by suggesting that I do not dispute that rural areas have both unique needs and geographical challenges in terms of representation when compared to more densely populated urban areas. What is in dispute is whether the recommendation that the most effective answer to these concerns is rural overrepresentation. Here, the Commission needs to examine the justifications being made for it and critically assess any evidence that could be used to support or challenge such claims. So what are the reasons that we typically hear in BC for overrepresenting rural areas? Well, they basically amount to geography. Let me revise that. They basically amount to too much geography and too little population. The geography arguments are rather uncontroversial. They say that representing huge geographic spaces is difficult. And we can admit that those challenges are real, but still point out that there are many possible responses to it that don't necessarily involve condoning overrepresentation. And I can go into more detail on some of those choices in the Q&A if you like. It's the population arguments, on the other hand, that actually distort and misrepresent what is going on in the province politically as concerns rural representation, and those are the ones that I think really need some critical examination. Population arguments are typically constructed like this. They begin with observations that the population in urban parts of the province is significantly greater than urban or are significantly greater than rural areas. This then leads to an assertion that rural areas are politically vulnerable to the dominant population of urban areas. Now, implied here is a notion that geographic location forms the basis of competing political coalitions and policy agendas, that rural areas represent a distinct and cohesive minority population in BC that is at risk, facing a possible tyranny of the majority from the more populated urban areas. And as such, it follows that rural areas need to be overrepresented to effectively defend their interests. Now, the problem with this justification is that there's very little evidence to support its claims and much to counter it. If such claims could be justified, we would expect to see them reflected in the election results and the behavior of elected representatives, but we do not. Examining election results over the past century in BC, we can note a number of patterns. First, no rural party has ever emerged as electorally viable. Voting patterns demonstrate that rural voters consistently support competing political coalitions that have support in both rural and urban areas. In fact, all three parties currently represented in the BC legislature have rural voting support and represent rural constituencies. Examining the political behavior of MLAs over time, we can also note that a number of patterns. Only candidates running with major parties have been elected as MLA as a rule. Very few independent candidates are elected, like candidates that would be taking up a rural representation role. There's no evidence of a rural focus as being distinct from party voting by MLAs. We don't see rural MLAs voting together as a group if they're not in the same party. Party voting is dominant, regardless of the urban or rural locale. Now, these facts should not be taken to mean that rural issues don't arise in politics or that they don't matter in the voting decision or behavior of politicians. What they mean is that rural voters do not share a consensus about how to respond to the challenges they face by being rural. The different party coalitions that rural voters support offer distinctly different solutions to rural challenges. Rural MLAs do not behave any differently than urban MLAs in legislative voting. Party affiliation trumps geography. However, In noting that rural voters support different rural-urban political coalitions and that all of these coalitions represent rural areas in the current BC legislature, that's not to say that all parties are equally able to turn their rural voting support into seats. In fact, over the past century, parties of the political right have been consistently overrepresented in rural areas and gained disproportionate benefit from the practice of rural overrepresentation, particularly the social credit dynasty from 1952 to 1991, and then again with the BC Liberals from 2001 to 2017. Let me come back to my earlier focus on justification and due weight. It is my contention that the conventional arguments offered to justify rural overrepresentation are not compelling, and as such do not warrant contemplating significant deviations from voter equality and voter parity between constituencies. As I hope I've made clear, the key problem with answering claims for rural overrepresentation is that they're based on a flawed understanding of what is being represented. The claims often paint a picture of underpopulated rural areas facing off against a more densely populated urban one in a kind of Mr. Smith goes to Washington sort of way, in a way that suggests that rural areas use a local champion that can represent their unique problems. But this isn't what voters are saying with their votes, and nor is it what rural representatives do when they're elected. I'm coming to my conclusion here. First, we need to recognize that there is no singular rural interest that needs representing. In fact, all three of BC's elected parties have considerable voting support in rural areas. This is important to note because all three parties offer distinctly different solutions to the problems that rural voters face. In other words, rural voters themselves disagree about how to respond to their unique problems. Second, rural interests do not appear to represent a separate interest that registers as important enough to lead to a specifically rural kind of representation. In other words, we don't see any rural party emerging or rurally focused individual representatives. Instead, rural voters vote for parties with significant urban support and representation. In other words, rural voters are part of larger political coalitions that extend beyond their rural location. Evidence for this is abundant and convincing. Voters vote party. They vote for a variety of parties. The elected representatives vote consistently with their party, as opposed to operating as purely local representatives or voting with other rural representatives from other parties. I think this leads to this conclusion. I think it's important for us to understand this for two reasons. One, rural voters would actually be more fairly represented by assuring that their chosen party, with its distinctive approach to rural issues, was best represented in the legislature as a whole, rather than focusing on the location of rural voters as the problem that requires attention. In other words, to give rural interests their proper due weight requires a different approach than rural overrepresentation. It requires that the diversity of rural political views, as represented by these pan-urban rural coalitions, get their equal and fair chance of gaining election. And of course, as I've suggested, there are potential harms that we can demonstrate with rural overrepresentation, not the least of which is that we can see over time that it has not benefited all parties equally. There's been a significant overrepresentation of certain groups. So I think that in the interest of democratic fairness and better representation better representing the unique needs of rural voters, moving toward greater equality in terms of the population between constituencies would be the better choice for the commission in redesigning BC's electoral map. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation today, being our first virtual presenter. My apologies for the mispronunciation of your last name, but thank you very much, and we look forward to receiving your presentation online. So the next presenter, Nathan Edelson has now arrived. So Nathan will be our next presenter. Nathan, I don't think you were here during the introductions. I'll just remind us we're keeping the presentations to 10 minutes. We have a number of people that would like to speak today. Therefore, just for consistency, 10 minutes. And if you'd like to turn your video on, we can see you, but it's certainly not mandatory.
Hi. Thank you very much. Forgive me this opportunity to provide my views on how to restore fairness to the electoral boundary system, especially for growing constituencies. And I share some of the views of the previous speaker and appreciate his in-depth research. I would speak to you based on my background as a community planner of more than 45 years. And although I've worked primarily in Metro Vancouver, I've had professional experience in quite a few other communities throughout British Columbia. I believe we can use important information from the past as well as current population to predict where population and demographic trends are going in the future. It doesn't take a crystal ball to predict that British Columbia's largest cities, primarily Vancouver and Surrey, will continue to grow rapidly over the next 5 years and beyond. But we also know this growth is happening in communities across the Lower Mainland, Fraser Valley, and Okanagan. From 2016 to 21, Vancouver has seen a population increase of nearly 8%, from about 631,000 to about 662,000 people. In the same period, Surrey grew even faster, by nearly 10%, from almost 518,000 to almost 588,000 people. It is now the geographic center for population and jobs in the metropolitan region. Although I recognize you have responsibility to ensure that voters from rural and remote constituencies have reasonable representation in the legislature, efforts must be made to ensure voters in urban areas are more fairly represented. The most important principle that we must work together is to protect representation by population. Using growth projections from BC statistics and taking into account recent census figures, Vancouver's population will increase by roughly 50,000 over the next 5 years, and Surrey will see an increase of roughly 65,000. Even adding two districts in Vancouver and two districts in Surrey may not be enough to address both the inequalities or inequities that exist in the current boundaries and future growth patterns. However, it would be a step in the right direction. We also know that electoral boundary commissioners in 2008 and 2016 were unable to take into account population growth when drawing up the electoral map. Commissioners were subject to legislation that guaranteed that the 17 rural and remote ridings be preserved, but placed a cap on the number of overall constituencies. Clearly, even commissioners themselves were uncomfortable with the restrictions put on them by this legislation and demonstrated what they said in their 2008 report. Quote, under the current legislative framework, it has become increasingly difficult to begin from the premise that deviations can be kept to a minimum. Indeed, while keeping ever mindful the need for relative population equality, we were drawn inexorably to recommend electoral districts with growing population inequality. Since that time, that population inequality has increased. The process this time will be different, giving you the opportunity to begin to rebalance the electoral map to ensure people who live in British Columbia's two largest cities and other rapidly growing centers are treated more fairly. Although Vancouver and Surrey's districts were within the legally permitted 25% variation last time, this variation can still lead to serious inequities if most of an urban region significantly provincial average. This is district so well below the 25% permitted deviation.
Nathan, I think we have an audio issue with your perhaps turning your video off may help the audio. You're getting frozen.
Say that the number of large and
commissioners, are you having the same issue as I am? Okay. It appears that we've lost Nathan. We'll move on to our next presenter, which is Pal Beasley.
Hi, good evening. I'm just going to turn on my, was it evening already? Yes, it is. Let me start my video. Okay, there we go.
Great.
First of all, thank you for providing the opportunity to provide feedback via Zoom. Not all of us can attend in person, so thank you so much. I would like to discuss something, an electoral writing very specific to Vancouver. And excuse me if this isn't like I'm breaking protocol or not following protocol. This is my first time speaking in one of these environments. It is my understanding that the electoral boundaries for the provincial ridings in South Vancouver are being considered to be redrawn. And I just wanted to kind of share my experience as a resident of Vancouver, Langara, and also share my work in the community to help kind of maybe frame the challenges we faced in having a kind of being a boundary riding essentially in a boundary neighborhood. I volunteer with a nonprofit currently with some friends. I've also served on boards for other nonprofits in the community as well. What we found is my friends and I and my co-volunteers is that at the provincial level, the neighborhood that we live in seems to get, I don't want to say ignored, but sometimes forgotten. And we find that the makeup of the demographics in our neighborhood differ from the rest of the demographics of the Langara riding. I don't want to suggest that the public servant isn't doing their due diligence. It's just, it seems as though we're not as prominent in the makeup of that neighborhood. And so we're a little different. Specifically, my parents are from India. So I'm, you know, of Indian descent and that's my ancestry. And so our neighborhood on the east side of Main Street is different from that of the makeup of the neighborhood on the west side of Main Street. And so I find that the demographics are more, I would say, similar to the riding of Vancouver-Fraserview at the provincial level. And I feel that if we were to be incorporated or separated in from Vancouver Langara, at the very least separated, I feel that we would have a little bit more of a strong voice for our neighborhood, especially at the provincial level. And working with the different nonprofits that I do, we found that, I'll circle back to my first point, is that we're quite often forgotten. And I feel that having our own writing, our own electoral writing, our own representative, that perhaps we would have our voices amplified and have a better avenue for our advocacy when looking for support from the provincial government. I just want to check in with the time. Do I have a couple more minutes?
You have a couple more minutes, yes.
Okay, I just want to just come back to my notes here. I would say that those are the key points. Really, that's it. That's all the time I really want to take. And I just want to say thank you again for providing this sort of forum and also taking my thoughts and ideas into consideration.
Thank you very much, Pal. I know it's a little bit intimidating to come and speak in official or formal presentations like this, but it's so good to hear personal perspectives. We can't possibly understand perspectives from communities and neighborhoods as you've given us, so we really do appreciate it. So thanks for taking your time.
Thank you.
Okay, we are now moving on to Daniel Tetrault.
Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. And thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today. I'm coming to you from the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh. My name is Daniel Tetrault, and I am the president of the Burnaby Teachers Association. So I'm going to be focusing more on Burnaby. Just a little background, the Burnaby School District is the fourth largest in the province, with roughly 25,000 students in kindergarten to grade 12. We have 41 elementary schools, 8 secondary schools, and 4,000 staff, and about 16,000 adult learners. With 50% of Burnaby's population born outside Canada and more than 100 languages spoken by our students, we are actually one of the most culturally diverse school districts in all of Canada. As you can imagine, it's been a very challenging time for teachers in the greater school community over the last 2 years through this pandemic. In addition to the pandemic, teaching kids in the overcrowded classrooms and with scarce resources, and also keeping our students and ourselves safe during this pandemic has been quite the challenge. And we are also playing catch up in education. So we went through over a period of over 15 years when the provincial government of the day made cuts and underinvested in education, and our students continue to pay the price for this. Since 2017, though, in our Supreme Court victory, we have seen the hiring of more teachers in Burnaby and the construction of new schools. But of course, there is still a lot to be done. Our experience is not unique to Burnaby. My colleagues throughout Metro Vancouver share the same challenges and realities as we do. So why am I giving you this background when we are talking about electoral boundaries? Well, I believe good decisions at the electoral level arise from having a large and diverse legislative assembly where people from a variety of backgrounds can bring their perspectives to governing. In my view, we need more voices from Burnaby and Metro Vancouver in general to make the case that we need increased investments in the education system to meet the needs of our growing communities. So if you look at the national census, the city of Burnaby grew by 7% from 2016 to 2021. So roughly 17,000 people. So 232,000 people to just over 249,000. Burnaby is also home to massive developments in some key neighborhoods, including Brentwood, Metrotown, Edmonds, and Lougheed. And also if you look at Burnaby's 10-year housing plan, the city is looking at densifying even more neighborhoods. So this will result in a significant increase in population. This has led also to, as you would imagine, increased school enrollment and the need for more schools to accommodate the growing student population. In fact, I don't know if you can hear him in the background, but my wife and I just welcomed our son to the world a couple of months ago. So you can count him as another one for future enrollment. Given this growth over the past decade and the likelihood that the trend will continue, it is necessary to add one electoral district for the city of Burnaby. By adding this additional electoral district, Burnaby will be able to catch up for some of the ground that was lost for more than a decade when the number of rural and northern constituencies remained unchanged as their populations declined. We need to ensure that voters in Burnaby are treated fairly, that their vote is roughly worth the same as other voters in the province, and that they have the electoral representation at the provincial level that they need. I want to thank you again for this opportunity to speak today, and I hope you have a good evening.
Thank you, Daniel, and congratulations on your new addition to your family. Certainly your message was consistent with a lot of what we heard when we were in Burnaby just last week as well. So thanks again for your presentation.
Thank you.
Okay, we will now move on to Maya Russell.
Sorry, I thought I was a few more speakers away and I just need a minute.
Would you like me to take another speaker?
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you.
Okay, we'll call another speaker and then I'll call back at you. So we will now call Gurveen Dhaliwal.
Hello. You folks can hear me all right?
Yes, you're nice and loud and clear.
Oh, perfect. Thank you so much for taking the time today to consider my presentation. My name is Gurveen Dhaliwal, and I'm a resident of Queensborough. And I'm here today to urge you to maintain Queensborough as a part of the Richmond-Queensborough electoral district. As you all are aware, the key principle when considering electoral boundaries is representation by population. And according to the recent census, the current population of Richmond is just under 210,000 people, meaning it is not actually large enough to support 4 standalone constituency. And as you may also be aware, the average constituency size is about 57,000 people, which means that this is actually one area of Metro Vancouver where the best course of action is to just maintain the status quo. And that's also because the previous Electoral Boundaries Commission looked for a solution that met the test of representation by population while also respecting communities of interest. So I feel, you know, Queensborough has proven to be an excellent fit in that regard. And first, let's consider the impact that the Fraser River has on Queensborough residents. I've been a resident of Queensborough my entire life, so I can definitely say traffic on the Queensborough Bridge creates a real barrier for residents in my community who are trying to get to the rest of New Westminster to access service. If it's either to go shopping or to get legal or routine medical appointment, it can be an irritant. And if it is to get to Royal Columbian Hospital because of a health emergency, it is a much more serious issue. And as a result, many people, myself included, are more likely to go to Richmond, including to Richmond General Hospital. And people in Queensborough who work in Vancouver commute through Richmond to get on either the Oak or Knight Street bridges and not through New Westminster and Burnaby. In addition, residents of Queensborough often drive to Richmond for religious service. So residents of Queensborough regularly travel to the Nongsar Gurdwara in Richmond. People in Hamilton and in the Hamilton community of Richmond, which is close to Queensborough, also often attend the Queensborough Gurdwara. And Muslims in Queensborough attend either one of the 2 mosques in Richmond. I also want to make the point, and I think this is a really important point, is that Richmond Queensborough was created in the last round of redistribution. And changing it again so quickly will likely confuse voters in these communities who have just now become accustomed to the existing boundaries. And that's all I have for you folks today. So thank you again for considering my proposal to maintain the current electoral boundaries for my community as they currently exist.
Thank you very much. As I mentioned with the last speaker, we very much appreciate that community perspective. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now we will call Maya Russell again and see if this will work out better. And Maya, you are muted. I'm not sure if you're trying to speak, but you're muted at this point. Nope. I think we will go to the next speaker and try Maya one more time. Oh, there we go. And there we go. Maya, are you there?
Yeah, I am. Thank you so much. I appreciate your patience and really appreciate the opportunity to present to the commission. So my name is Maya Russell. I'm a resident of New Westminster in the Sapperton neighborhood. I was raised in Surrey and I lived in Vancouver before moving to New Westminster about 12 years ago. I have a bachelor's degree in geography from SFU, and I'm also a parent of 3 students in the New Westminster school system, and I am a school trustee, was elected in 2018. I'm not speaking on behalf of my Board of Education this evening, but I am obviously drawing on my experience as both a parent and a school trustee. I've so a little bit of experience as well with government representation, having worked in constituency offices for members of parliament and MLAs providing services to local constituencies. But my main concern tonight is just as a in terms of schools, government representation is very important to us. It relates to budget decisions since the province is the sole funder of K-12 education, and it relates to laws and policies. My first concern is about the representation of urban voters in a community such as ours and the weighting of legislature seats strongly in favor of rural voters. I don't need to tell you, obviously, that the most important principle is the integrity of one person, one vote. I was very alarmed to learn the extent to which an urban person's vote has less weight than a person living in a rural area. I would argue that this weighting towards rural representation on the basis that it's harder to service a geographic area is no longer a valid argument. Technology changes with the internet. During the pandemic, we saw mass shifts to adopt the use of video conferencing and other internet tools. We've seen increases in provision of high-speed broadband internet, which ensures that in almost every community of the province, there is access to high-speed internet. So I would argue that this huge weighting on the basis of geographic size is no longer a valid reason. And then obviously this matters because the issues relevant to urban voters are different from in some really key ways, looking at things like public infrastructure, public transit, housing affordability, as just a few. So a second concern is that even if the current skew was corrected as of today's population data, there are different growth rates, which mean that this divide will only continue to grow. I know that the population growth rate in BC's rural areas, which is 0.5%, is 17 times slower than the growth rate in urban areas, which in BC, as I understand it from StatsCan, is 8.7%. This is a massive difference, and I really believe we should correct the inequity now and really correct for future anticipated growth by skewing towards urban representation now. Third, perhaps most egregiously, there are significant differences in the makeup of populations on the basis of race and ethnicity between urban and rural seats in our province. We know that people who are not white are significantly more likely to live in an urban constituency in British Columbia. StatsCan confirms that most immigrants settle in large urban areas. The challenge is well documented in many reports, including the Public Policy Forum's report issued just a few days ago called Settling the Unsettled. The fact that a person's vote is weighted less based on with this impact is, I think many would agree, a racist outcome of our current electoral boundaries. Regardless of whether that is the intent, that is the outcome. It is based on race and ethnicity. And I would say this clearly meets the test of a discriminatory impact. I would also say we cannot be colorblind to this impact in this issue. It is egregious. So then lastly, I'll just talk a little bit about the school board level. So urban districts have some significantly different funding and policy priorities than rural school districts. Classroom needs are different when a significant number of students are learning English as an additional language. We are serving urban Indigenous students who may come from dozens of home nations and dozens of Indigenous languages. And perhaps most significantly, school capital funding and funding policies hurt urban districts. So the policies about school capital funding are currently written with kind of equal consideration to the scenario of growing enrollment or declining enrollment. But the urban area I'm in and those in the region around me are facing a constant reality of growing enrollment. Declining enrollment is not in the cards for us and hasn't been for a very long time. It used to be that to get a school capital budget approved, you could only use your current enrollment numbers, which meant we were constantly falling behind. The current government did start to allow us to consider enrollment growth, which is fantastic, but there's a huge amount of catch up and it's still very difficult to get funding approved based on future enrollment. So an example would be we have a beautiful new high school in British Columbia, largest education construction project of its kind in the province's history. We squeezed some additional classrooms into this high school so that we could meet enrollment for the next few years. But after a few years, we will be over-enrolled in our beautiful high school. International students are a significant source of funding through the payment of international fees in our district and many others, but we will not have room for them. So due to the space constraints, we'll be losing the voices of those students. We'll also be losing the significant funding. So there's kind of a secondary impact from the way the policies are set up. As of 2021, our enrollment was 7,610 students. In 10 years, that'll be 9,273 students. So we are looking for space for over 1,600 more students. Our Fraser River zone, our downtown area, is growing very fast. We have a lot of young families moving to downtown New Westminster. Our two schools, Kakite Elementary and Lord Kelvin, are very full. Lord Kelvin Elementary at 122% utilization rate based on the ministry standards. Kakite Elementary at 114%. That school in particular, by 2031, will be at 147%. Currently has several portables already, so it's hard to imagine what that would be like at that time. Obviously, we're advocating for and looking forward to funding to build a new school. These schools also, as it is, have very limited green space. They already have to use adjacent city parks for the outside play space or for gym. These parks are not really designed for school use, and it takes that green space out of the neighborhood's use during the school day in a busy downtown neighborhood. Looking at the cost of capital in urban areas is also really different. So we are an old city, oldest in the province. There are no vacant lots that meet the ministry's requirements. It's very difficult to put together a parcel that meets the ministry's requirements for green space. So currently our school sites are actually all in shortfall under the current site area standards, except for one school, FW Howie, beautiful school with a huge yard. But the total shortfall of the space that we're supposed to have is equivalent to the size of four schools. These requirements for green space are just not realistic in an urban area. An average school site in British Columbia, I believe, is about 7 acres. And if you think about this community of New Westminster, there are no lots for sale in New Westminster with that kind of space. They just do not exist. Any lots that come close to that size have significant drawbacks and serious environmental considerations. For example, we have a hazardous rail route running through our city that impacts a number of lots that would otherwise be considerable. So our capital budgets, Treasury Board funding decisions, ministry policies are all set by a legislature that does not represent the constituents of communities like ours. We have formidable MLAs who advocate very hard for us and are very effective, but it's a concern to me that that is harder than it should be, and we have to wonder what it would be like if that representation was different. The end result of this one example of capital funding policies is real harm. It's real crowding. These are real students in portables. Families do not like their kids generally being in school portables. There's a separation from the school community and the amenities that come with those. They're crowded into the halls, causing more stress and more conflict. Students with disabilities who are sensitive to noise have no break, whether it's inside the classroom or outside in a busy schoolyard. There's a lack of green play space. There's a lack of playing fields, and there's a lack of flexibility for us to accommodate a family who might want to be at the next neighboring school because of maybe childcare arrangements. Many, many reasons why it causes a lot of hardship and difficulty, and why I think that this matter of urban representation is incredibly important thank you so much for listening.
Thank you very much, Maya, for taking such time to prepare a thorough presentation. And I'm glad we got the technical difficulty sorted out there. So thank you.
Thank you.
For anybody that joined us late, I just want to note, if you do wish to be added to the speakers list, just use the raise hand bar that's on your toolbar, on your Zoom toolbar, and you'll be added to the speakers list. So our next speaker is Emmett Mark.
Hello. Thank you so much, commissioners, for letting me, a young person, present to you this evening. Currently, I'm a graduate student studying democratic engagement and voter participation at Carleton University in our nation's capital, but I am a native resident of British Columbia, having been born and grown up in Richmond, British Columbia. So the opportunity to kind of present and maybe fix some pressing issues regarding the electoral redistribution in my home community is absolutely an opportunity I very much would like to jump at. So I've been very closely kind of following this. I suppose this kind of following the electoral redistribution, both provincially, as well as what's happening federally this summer, has really been sort of my go-to thing to procrastinate on when I really should be writing term papers for my degree. And I've really noticed is that there is major malapportionment between rural and urban areas, as has been discussed by previous speakers during this forum. Another factor that I am aware of is that the BC NDP government has restored independence to this commission in creating or more independence, more so to create or draw new boundaries, increasing the number of MLAs from 87 to 93. So kind of in that factor, the electoral quotient of the average riding in this province has gone down to about 54,000 individuals. And with the 2021 census, the results of that count being now public as of several weeks ago, the city of Richmond, where I'm from, is currently have about 210,000 residents. And I think, so I'll kind of go to kind of the three major points that I wanted to bring home. And of course, I've prepared documents related to my presentation that will be distributed to the commission afterwards. But with 210,000 people living in the city of Richmond, that is essentially almost fits perfectly four provincial ridings within the city uniquely. So I'll kind of go through the three major points that I'd like to see in the city of Richmond in this sort of round of electoral redistribution. Firstly, I do believe that the removal of Queensborough from the Richmond-Queensborough riding to a riding that is uniquely located within the city of New Westminster is necessary given population growth and urban growth in both Richmond and New Westminster. New Westminster is one of the fastest growing municipalities in the Lower Mainland. And previously, under the 2015 electoral redistribution in this province, the city of New Westminster take away the community of Queensborough could fit neatly into a single provincial district. Currently, I don't believe that's the case, especially with the electoral quotient of the average ridings. Assuming that we are increasing to 93 seats in this province, remains the case. So likewise, we do need to remove the community of Queensborough from the Richmond-Queensborough riding. Secondly, as a young person who's likely going to be living in a condo or an apartment or some sort of high-rise building for the next decade, I think Richmond absolutely needs the creation of a purely urban dense district in the city center comprised entirely of these urban high-rise buildings. Currently, the city center of the city of Richmond is divided into two districts, Richmond North Center and Richmond South Center, which I think given the 2015 redistribution was appropriate, but now with major urban densification in the city of Richmond, as well as kind of a clearly defined boundaries of the city center as released by the city of Richmond in their official community development planning report, it is now very clear that the city center in the city of Richmond is kind of split across two ridings, and it's necessary that we create a purely sort of urban Richmond Center riding that caters directly to and is comprised entirely of those sort of high-rise urban dense buildings in the city. And thirdly, I'd like to see that the commission suggests or takes a look into potentially renaming the Richmond-Stevenson riding to a name that better reflects the community. When the riding was created 30 years ago, obviously the community of Stevenson in the Richmond-Stevenson riding did comprise the majority of the population. But in the succeeding 30 years, as the community has grown and as the community has changed, I believe the 2021 census has revealed that the community of Stevenson no longer comprises the majority of the district. It's now I believe the community of Stevenson has approximately 23,000-24,000 individuals. If the electoral quotient in the province is at 54,000, I'm not really sure if that reflects the continuity of that community or the name of the riding. And so potentially this commission might suggest potentially looking into other names that potentially reflect the community better as a whole. So I guess I have created kind of there's a great open source program that's been released called Riding Builder that myself and many of my friends have been spending a lot of time looking at. So it divides up the city into city blocks, and sort of members of the public will be able to kind of create their own sort of ridings based off of what they perceive to be communities of interest. And so likewise, I'll be submitting after my presentation, but I have kind of created a little map that details kind of what I would kind of view as a community of interest if we're dividing the city of Richmond into four provincial ridings. And then I'll just do a quick rundown of how I kind of grouped everything and for the consideration by the commission here. Let me just pull that up. But I think for the most part, kind of the recreation of a riding, of a Richmond East riding without the community of Queensborough, that kind of begins at Highway 99, cuts down south with Number 4 Road, and then is also east of the current demarcation of Number 3 Road, a sort of Richmond Southwest type riding that replaces Richmond Stevenson. Given that Stevenson is no longer the majority of the community, I figured, given the precedence of communities such as Scarborough and Toronto, Calgary and Edmonton in the naming of their provincial and federal ridings, I think perhaps renaming the riding Richmond Southwest might be more appropriate given the sort of more diverse nature within that community, more specifically that kind of exists below Blundell Road and west of Number 3 Road, a purely urban riding in this Richmond city center that kind of comprises of eight major city blocks, primarily residential high rises and urban areas that are reflected in the city of Richmond's community development plans, as well as a new riding of Richmond North that kind of comprises the remainder of the territory of the city of Richmond north of those sort of three districts. And then as well, I think ensuring that we have diversity in our legislature, or ensuring that diverse communities of voters have the ability to elect representatives of their choice is an issue that is quite important to me. So kind of this map that I've created does create three minority majority districts, as well as a sort of minority influence district where invisible minorities comprise at least 40% of the voting population. And so I'll be very happy to kind of submit this map to this commission for your consideration. Again, the three major points that I'd like to really drive home is the removal of Queensborough from a Richmond-based riding to New Westminster, given kind of urban growth in both of the communities, the creation of a purely dense and urban seat directly in the city center that's comprised entirely of urban high-rise buildings and urban density, as well as the renaming of the Richmond-Stevenson district. Thank you so much for your time. I look forward to making my submission.
Thank you very much, Emmett. It is good that we are hearing from some young people, both at our in-person presentations and here. That was a good segue into something that I forgot to mention earlier, that we'll look forward to seeing the maps that you create, but also on our website within, they tell me now, 2 to 3 weeks, we'll have a mapping tool right on our website that anybody can go into and create what, you know, visually create what they're wanting to present to us as well. So anyone that's listening here, you may want to check that out within the next 2 to 3 weeks. And thank you again. Okay, the next speaker that we will have is Neelam Sahota. I appreciate for those that have come in late, and I note that there's quite a few that came in a little bit late. I appreciate that all of our presenters are staying within the 10 minutes that we've allocated to the presentation. So that's much appreciated. And Neelam is on the way.
Hello, good evening. Thank you to the BC Electoral Boundaries Commission for the opportunity here to present My name is Neelam Sahota. I'm a resident of Surrey for the past 24 years. I'm also a first-generation Canadian, being born and raised in the Lower Mainland. I'm an alumni of Simon Fraser University with a Bachelor of Business Administration and a Fellow of the Chartered Professional Accountants of BC. I'm also Board Governor of Simon Fraser University and the past Treasurer of the Immigrant Employment Council of BC and past Chair of Surrey Libraries. Today, I'm wearing the hat of the CEO of Diversity Community Resources Society. Diversity Community Resources Society is Surrey's very first immigrant and settlement serving organization. We assist with newcomers that are settling into this region with every facet of their journey to becoming contributing citizens of this community. My work as CEO of Diversity is guided by representation of those voices that are often marginalized. I'm also guided by doing this work in one of the most fastest growing urban regions, namely Surrey, British Columbia. I'm coming to you today also as the co-chair of the Surrey Local Immigration Partnership, which is a community partnership bringing diverse voices together to build an equitable and inclusive city where all immigrants, refugees, and citizens thrive. Through dialogue and research, the partnership's 30-plus members, which represent various sectors, collaborate on innovative and community-driven strategies to meet the changing needs of one of the fastest-growing cities in British Columbia. As Surrey's cultural diversity grows, so does the need to review and refine policies, practices, services, and programs that support the community. This also includes political voice representation. Surrey is one of the most diverse cities in our province, with one of the fastest growing immigrant populations in BC. Its needs are complex and unique and need strategic representation to address the unique regional needs of the community and its newest residents. The federal government's immigration policy will reach unprecedented levels with multi-year immigration levels. It is projected that over the next decade, 500,000 a year for the foreseeable future of new immigration is not projected to be out of the realm. Within British Columbia, over 25% of the province's immigration growth has been settling into Surrey, and these numbers are only projected to increase. The demographics of these immigrants is also a unique factor for Surrey's consideration. The demographics that we're seeing are that the newcomers are young. The percentage of Metro Vancouver's residents between the ages of 15 and 34 are represented at 41% of recent immigrants, as opposed to 27% of the Canadian-born residents. These newcomers are also well-educated. The percentage of Metro Vancouver's residents possessing a bachelor's degree or higher is represented at 45% of recent immigrants, as opposed to 31% of total residents. And they work hard. The labor force participation by recent immigrants is 65% of newcomers participating in the labor force, as opposed to 9% who are unemployed. They speak many different languages. 7 out of 10 of Metro Vancouver's Punjabi mother tongue population lives in Surrey. Top 5 languages most often spoken at home by immigrants in Surrey are Punjabi, Mandarin, Tagalog, Hindi, and Korean. All of the aforementioned points are to highlight that not only is Surrey's population growth outpacing that of any other municipality in the province in total, but the type of population growth is also the most diverse. Surrey's taking the lion's share of the province's immigration today and has increased projections for the immigration strategy for the future. Surrey also has the youngest population of any other municipality, and the number of eligible voters will also be set to increase. Surrey School District is the largest of the province. Surrey also represents the largest urban Indigenous population. Surrey is also geographically the largest region urban center within the Lower Mainland. The diversity and growth of this region is undeniable and on a scale not ever seen before. While communities in more rural parts of the province tend to be less diverse, we know that constituencies in Surrey have significantly larger populations on average than those in places like the Cariboo or the Kootenays, for example. This has created a large inequity in that people in diverse communities like Surrey have less representation. It takes more votes for diverse communities to elect an MLA than it does for less diverse communities. In some cases, it takes 2 to 3 times as many people to elect an MLA in places like Surrey than it does in other more rural places. This means a vote in Surrey is worth much less than a vote in many rural communities. We believe the Commission needs to make changes to ensure everyone's vote matters equally in British Columbia. We also know that Surrey is not alone in this, although it is arguably the one key city where underrepresentation is the key staggering issue. Adding new seats in Surrey and other diverse communities would help fix these problems and improve representation for people in these communities. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present.
Thank you, Neelam. Very much appreciated. We will now call on Jeffrey Andrus. Hello.
Hello. So hi, my name is Jeff Andrus and I both live and work in Vancouver, False Creek. I work on Vancouver or Granville Island and live next to the stadium. Every day I'm able to take the ferry to and from work on the island as I have a yearly pass, which keeps me connected throughout the community. My evenings are often spent taking my dog for a walk at Cooper's Park in Yale Town, then continuing on to Olympic Village where me and my partner will grab a coffee and then continue on to the Olympic Village dog park before coming home. The seawall connects the community. It is all one area. I am very lucky to live and work in the False Creek area, and I believe it is one of the best urban neighborhoods in Canada. I love spending time walking along the seawall with my partner and dog, buying groceries at Granville Island Market on the weekend and on the way home from work, and going to dinner at one of the great restaurants on either the south or north side of False Creek. I am walking distance to Rogers Arena, where I can see the Canucks, or to BC Place where I can watch the Lions or the Whitecaps. Granville Island is on the south side of False Creek, but it is the heartbeat of the neighborhood. When people of Yale Town are looking for something to do, that's where they go. They don't go to Cole Harbor. It is disconnected from the area and isn't considered part of the neighborhood. Granville Island is a cultural hub offering easy access to people from both sides of False Creek, including the Waterfront Theater and the Carousel Theater for young people. The fireworks from the annual Festival of Lights are seen on both sides of False Creek. It is a natural community of interest. The current electoral boundaries in our constituency make sense because both people on both sides of False Creek have many shared experiences. The people who live in and around Olympic Village use the same amenities as people who live in Yale Town, including the parks and dog parks, beaches, and community centers. They live in that area because of the access to SkyTrain lines, as well as to the water taxis that allow for efficient and safe car-free travel. People live in these communities because they sought out an urban lifestyle. Their interests are often very different from other neighborhoods that have a mix of single-family and smaller multifamily homes, and where an urban lifestyle is not always as desirable. Given the growth of Vancouver, I am certain that you're looking to add at least one electoral district. I also know that False Creek is one of the highest growth areas of the city, which means you're likely to looking to redraw the boundaries to adjust for growth. But as you're considering those boundaries, it is my hope that you strive as much as possible to maintain the positive characteristics of the current False Creek constituency. I believe that the constituency could continue to straddle the seawall because of the path that connects the neighborhood that we all come home. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Jeff. We will now call our next speaker, Doug Elford. Doug, there we go.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. Thank you.
Thank you very much for allowing me to speak here today. Just want to introduce myself. I'm a counselor for the city of Surrey, and I just want to thank the commissioners for putting all the time in to do this. It's going to be quite exciting to see what your decisions are down the road. I just want to mention as a background, I believe I'm a sixth generation British Columbian now, which makes my grandchildren eighth generation, which I'm quite proud of. And I've lived in the city of Surrey for over 40 years. So I just want to address the commission. I heard a very eloquent presentation just before us on Surrey and really just kind of stole my thunder a bit here. But I just want to carry on I've got some points that I'd like to make for you guys to hear. I know you're focusing much of your attention on ensuring the principle of representation by population receives particular focus as electoral boundaries are considered. I'm encouraged that you're paying so much attention on this very important issue, given that city officials project that our population will increase to more than 632,000 by 2026 and to 730,000 by 2036. I honestly think these numbers are low, but that certainly indicates that we need additional electoral districts. And so I'm going to direct my comments around the need to ensure that whenever possible, electoral districts with the name Surrey attached to them are contained within our city limits. I also think that as you move forward, new electoral districts should be located in the areas of high growth over the past decade and should also consider further growth. While all Surrey has grown, some parts of the city are experiencing dramatic expansion. We're creating a downtown core, as many of you know, the second downtown city core in the province. And just the applications for the amount of density we're seeing is just it's exponential. It's just unbelievable. It's hard to fathom. Other parts of Surrey as well are growing exponentially. Newton was projected to grow by 265,000 by 2031. Literally, that's the size of Kelowna, one neighborhood. So Surrey will grow exponentially too, to 117,000. And Wally, of course, the city center is growing. But we're also looking at, we've approved plans for the Annie-Dale Tynehead area. You know, we're literally dropping the 20,000 people into that community over the next decade. That's like the city of White Rock dropping into a neighborhood. And in the southeast, it's growing really, really fast through our OCPs. We just can't build fast enough out there, and it's quite challenging for us. But certainly, we're planning on dealing with our rapid expanding population. Given that our population continues to grow in our community, it's clear we at least need two additional seats, electoral seats, to ensure the votes of Surrey residents are fairly represented in BC. Some may argue three. If you're relooking this, 9 years down the road, I'm not exactly sure what the timing is, but you know, by the time you're relooking at this, we may be, you know, demand or asking for more representation as well down the road. But we also want to make sure that our MLAs are focused, three MLAs are focused on issues that affect Surrey and not other communities. I guess your task is quite challenging, and I understand that in some circumstances you're required to take some population from some municipalities to make others work. However, when at all possible, this should be avoided. For example, it makes very little sense to have an electoral district that includes Surrey and Langley because they are really different communities, believe me, with very different issues and very different demographics. And given that Surrey continues to grow faster than the communities it surrounds, I believe that we have a sufficient population base to support standalone seats. I think that's about it. All the other issues have been covered by previous speakers about Surrey, and so I just want to wrap it up and allow other speakers the opportunity to speak. And again, thank you for letting me speak to you today, and good luck on your deliberations down the road.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks for your preparation, your thoughts, your perspectives. We appreciate it. Moving to the next speaker, we have James Infante. And I apologize if I've mispronounced.
Hello. Yes, and you pronounced it perfectly, so thank you. Well, hello, commissioners. My name is James Infante, and I'm a 27-year-old young professional who lives on the stolen and occupied lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples, known as the East Side of Vancouver. I was born and raised on these lands to immigrant parents from the Philippines, who taught me to leave the world in a better place than how I found it. And it is in that spirit that I join you here today. I'm here to tell you that representation matters. It matters especially to those who have been told that for decades their voices don't matter. It especially matters for those who have inherited centuries of generational trauma and colonization. And it matters especially for those who aren't here today to participate in public forums such as these, of which I'm grateful to be joining. I come to this presentation as a young urban professional, a nonprofit leader serving on community boards, and as a committed community volunteer, spending much of my time serving those on the east side of Vancouver. I also come to this meeting representing all parts of me. I join today as a first-generation Canadian, as a queer person, and as a person of color. Living at an intersection of such diverse identities, I consider it a responsibility to be able to present. I'm privileged to have the means and comforts to be here today and speak confidently. It is likely that I will be seen as sharing on behalf of those who identify with me, many of whom are so rarely represented at commissions like these. I never knew what it meant to see myself reflected in public life. I so often was subtly told by the world around me what place I had in society. I was told what place I had in society through the ways I saw myself represented on TV, or really lack thereof, through who was prioritized for particular jobs and who I saw was living to the conventional definitions of success at school. I was also told what place I had in society based on who I saw or didn't see in BC's legislature. When you don't see yourself reflected in all areas of your community, what you can see as possible for yourself is limited. You can't achieve that which you cannot see. We need more young people like me and others of equity-seeking identities to be able to see themselves included in society and reflected in our political system. It is how you build a more inclusive community, and it's how you foster a sense of belonging and shared identity. As a young person, I didn't feel that sense of community and the sense of responsibility to others until I saw the first person of Philippine ancestry elected to the legislature, Mabel Elmore. A queer Filipino woman, first ever to be elected, I finally understood what it meant to be seen as a young Filipino Canadian. I began volunteering at her office, and I really felt like I belonged. Volunteering for my local MLA, MLA Elmore, in one of the most diverse ridings in the province, I finally knew what it meant to have a voice that was validated, that was valued, and was heard. I think about the power of representation and the effect it can have on young people's lives. I think about having role models and people in public life you can look up to that reflect the communities that you identify with. It tells young people that they matter, that they can achieve any successes that they want, and that we all have a place in the community which we call home. But it can't just be on a handful of MLAs of color or those who represent unique, diverse identities to carry the burden of representing those who identify with them. Having an equitable system of representation relies on a structure which values all voices equally. And as riding distributions stand today in BC, I do not see their composition being one based on equity. If equitable representation matters, then representation ought to be based on population. BC's current riding composition does not currently reflect that. The current distribution of ridings disproportionately favor rural areas, which are less densely populated. Rural areas are older, they are whiter, and they are less diverse and are currently, in my perspective, overrepresented. Ridings in communities like mine in Vancouver have almost twice as many people in them compared to ridings in rural BC. Yet they don't receive higher levels of representation in our political system. And this just isn't right. One could take that to mean that votes in urban areas are worth half as much as they are in rural areas because urban ridings sometimes have almost double the population of rural ridings. It means that folks of color, queer folks, young people, and those living with disabilities, many of which live in urban centers, don't have an equal number of voices in the legislature. We know that larger populations of equity-seeking identities live in cities. The number of folks of color, along with young people and other equity-seeking groups, are moving to cities like Vancouver, Burnaby, and Surrey in greater numbers. But still, they face an absence of equal representation. To summarize, those a part of equity-seeking groups are concentrated in populous areas. And populous areas in BC are not equally represented. And yet many people question why equity-seeking groups have a lower than average voter turnout. Perhaps if we're to equally represent those who live in cities, which compared to rural areas, as we know, disproportionately include the communities I've named, we might have a chance to better engage these communities and decrease the barrier to political participation and increase voter turnout. If we're to believe that representation matters, it must also be true that more representation is needed in urban areas of BC. We know that folks a part of equity-seeking groups face greater barriers to participation in public life and are currently underrepresented in our legislature. When ridings reflect an equal number of voters and citizens, it will mean that citizens will be better engaged in their communities. This is particularly true for equity-seeking groups. In closing, representation really does matter. However, in BC's current riding configuration, urban voices aren't being given the representation they deserve. Changes must be made to balance the representation of more populated areas in our province. This includes cities like Vancouver, Burnaby, and Surrey, just to name a few. It will better engage a demographic of younger people, gender-diverse folks, people living with disabilities, Indigenous peoples, Black folks, communities of color, and other equity-seeking groups when they are better represented. We know that when people are better represented, we're all better for it. I ask the commissioners to seriously consider the number of seats in urban centers to better represent the principle of representation by population. It can only serve the people of BC better. Thank you for taking the time to hear me today.
Thank you, James. Thank you so much for your well-articulated and thoughtful comments that will be included in as we go through our process for sure. Thank you. We now have two more speakers that have signed up. As I mentioned earlier, if you do wish to speak and you haven't yet raised your hand on the bar on the bottom of the Zoom bar, you may do so. At this time, we'll call Kennedy Stewart.
Good evening. Can you see and hear me okay?
I can both see and hear you, yes.
Great. Well, thank you so much for this opportunity to present to you this evening on this very important topic. I have been listening with great interest and intent to the speakers preceding me. And I have a few things to add, but I must say I was impressed by the quality of the presentations, as I'm sure you were. I'm speaking today, of course, from the unceded traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people, and thank them for their continued partnership as we work together to build Vancouver's future. It is a great pleasure to present to you this evening on why the City of Vancouver should see its provincial electoral boundaries updated to include more ridings so as to better represent our city. I first want to say, though, this is a great pleasure. When I was a political scientist, an active political scientist at SFU, I always thought a boundaries commission work would be kind of a dream job. And I actually do have some former colleagues, Linda Erickson and, of course, Ken Carty from UBC, who served as boundaries commissioners. So that didn't happen. So then I went to the other side of the ledger and was elected federally in the ridings of Burnaby Douglas. And of course, that riding went through a boundaries review federally and was, of course, kind of divided in half. So I did participate in that process. And I really now being mayor of Vancouver want to put my two cents in for representation in our city. I do want to say that I have studied electoral boundary commissions around the world, and the integrity that that this commission is known for is international. So I do want to thank you for your service and bringing a lot of like I said, integrity to what can be a fraught process. So thank you again for your service, both on this commission and on the benches and also at Elections British Columbia. So thank you for your work here. I won't take up too much of your time. I do want to say that when we had Electoral Boundaries Commission Act change in 2014, which created a minimum of seats in three regions, I think that was problematic for the area that I'm representing, Vancouver. So my job is to advocate on their behalf, and that's what I'm going to do today. I do feel like this previous decision reduced the advocacy capacity in the provincial legislature from our city. So I think this is a great time to revise boundaries and to make up for the lack of representation in the last few years, but to make sure we plan our democracy with future growth and the growth of new voters as they come on to the system, and keep that all in mind. So according to BC Stats figures, Vancouver is projected to grow by 50,000 people in the next 5 years and 100,000 over the next decade. And I think these, as we heard from Surrey, my colleague from Surrey, Doug Elford, these may be conservative estimates. For one, recent CMHC data shows now, as of January 2022, we have almost 10,000 units of housing under construction currently. We look at what we have approved, and those figures will be coming out shortly from our planning department. We have approved way more than that in the coming years. So just so you know, in 2017, the city set a target of 72,000 housing units to be built over 10 years. That's roughly 7,200 a year. We by far exceeded that now, as was my goal as mayor, and I think we're going to grow even more. So if you think many of those units are more than studios or one bedrooms, they can accommodate more than one person. A lot of folks that will be in those homes shortly. And every year I can see these totals of units being built every year for many years to come and more than that. So there's a lot of folks coming to this city, as you all know. We also have a large number of planning exercises underway. So, for example, we have the Broadway Corridor Plan that is coming to council in the next few weeks. That is a 500-block area that is we're calling it the second downtown, or that's what is being referred to at the moment. That will be built along the current, the new SkyTrain route that begins tunneling next spring. So that should bring an additional 40,000 new homes to that corridor, as well as a massive amount of employment with the office towers and those types of things. So that is a major, I think, potential for growth in population in this city. And we're not stopping there. We have a Vancouver plan, which is also coming to council probably in June, which will outline how we intend to grow. I've asked for an aggressive plan that will, of course, increase density. And our we're only 4% of the region in terms of land area, but we are very densely populated, and that will continue to increase over the coming years. I guess I also want to talk about First Nations, the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh. They have a development corporation. It's called MSTDC. I'm, of course, not speaking on their behalf, but I do want to say that there are significant plans for development of lands. MST are the largest now landholders in the city of Vancouver and have said significant development plans, including Jericho, for example, which the city is working through a planning process now, the Heatherlands and a number of other lands around the city. The Squamish First Nation have reserve lands at the foot of the Burrard Street Bridge, and we're moving ahead with plans working with them. We don't have much control over reserve lands. That's really the purview of the nation, but we are working with them in partnership to provide services for what could be up to 15,000 people living at the southern side of the Burrard Street Bridge. So I think the previous council set a fairly ambitious target, and we've well exceeded that in terms of what's being built. Actually, it's not theory anymore. It's actually practice. These shovels are in the ground, and what's to come in the coming years. So if you love dense cities, which like I do, this is exciting for us. It's exciting for the province in terms of job growth and accommodating that. Mayor's TransLink Council looking at extending the SkyTrain all the way to UBC, which is the busiest transit corridor in North America at the moment without a subway line. That again will only add to population at UBC through their development, and perhaps future development at the UBC golf course. So there is which is currently Musqueam territory. So if you think what's coming to this city, I'm very excited about it, but it would seem to demand considerations of future additional future representatives, because the ones that we have now are excellent, and I enjoy speaking to all of them, but they have a lot of work to do, and have a few extra colleagues to help out would be a good addition. Let's see now. In terms of other growth, just so you know, we have 57 co-ops in the city of Vancouver. We've struck an agreement in principle, a framework with all these co-ops, which we think will double the number of occupants within these co-ops that are spread across the city. So you can kind of get the gist of my theme here is that things are moving fast. And we know through our consultation, through our very detailed Vancouver plan process, is that this is what the public wants. 80% are saying they want density, choice of housing in neighborhoods right across the city. So I think you will see a dramatic transformation. And what's great is that this isn't a fight with the public. It's working to deliver on their what their desires are, which is great. Let's see. I just have to say, having studied politics and then been in it at the federal level and at the local level, I do think that the politics has changed quite a lot. I'm currently trying to recruit candidates to run in the fall election, and I have seen quite a change in especially young people getting involved in politics. People that you might have thought 10 years ago would have jumped at the opportunity to join in a local election now are hesitant, just because of the workloads, because of the challenges in dealing with let's face it, racism, online hate, those types of concerns. And so in some cases, I think it, in a way, more is better to distribute the workload, to build a larger team of colleagues to cooperate with, to share experiences and to try to make sure we buttress our democracy with you know, I think in this case, more is better. So I think it's 93 that you have as a top limit. In terms, I would think that would be British Columbia is very quickly growing very quickly. I think that, you know, for me, I think that would be a good number to recommend, although of course that's your purview. But I do think that all of us have to take this work very seriously, because as we see around the world these days, you know, there's ebbs and flows for democracy, and we have to get back to the flow side. We have to keep the faith in our current system, but we have to reinforce and make sure that we lead the world in terms of how we you know, we conduct our public affairs. So I do, that's all I really have to say. I just wanted to thank you so much for your work. It's very important work, but I know that you individually, but also as a group, are held in very high regard. And I have complete faith in what you'll come up with in terms of report. So thank you so much for your time this evening. And I look forward to seeing what comes out of this.
Thank you, Mayor Stewart. As all of them, very much appreciated. We certainly hearing the importance of taking into consideration population growth estimates and the value that local governments may have for us in things like the building permits, development agreements, et cetera, that might provide more insightful information. So thank you.
Could I just add one thing? I was just very struck by a number of folks who came in for the first time from racialized and diverse backgrounds. And I do agree with previous speakers that that has to be clearly recognized through this process. I think perhaps, and I'm learning that, you know, there's systemic racism in all institutions, whether it's, you know, city, provincial or federal level. And I'm not saying that's the people that are involved, but I'm saying it's the way the system impacts different members of our community. So I would really ask that you keep a close eye on that when you're thinking about how communities are, you know, you have to draw lines sometimes through communities, but I ask you keep that careful attention to that as you make your decisions. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Our next speaker is just listed as Dawn. So Dawn will come up as a presenter now. Maybe you could let us know your full name for the recording record.
Yeah, good evening. My name is Dawn Grant. I had actually put my request in on March 8th. I hadn't heard anything back. Yeah. So there may be some people who have been missed on this process. I thought you should know that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And as I mentioned at the beginning, this was our first virtual one. So any feedback we get is appreciated. We'll follow up with it. Thank you.
Yeah, so that's why I thought I'd let you know that. Okay. First of all, good evening. Thanks for the opportunity. This is my third time I've done presentations to two other boundary commissions in the past. So a couple of things I'm fairly passionate about. One, I'll get to it in a second, which is about the representation outside of the Lower Mainland. But I will say, as a fifth-generation British Columbian, fourth-generation Lower Mainlander, we have a family business based in East Richmond, been there for 40 years. So that's going to be the first part I'd like to talk about. Queensborough historically has always been part of New Westminster. That end of Lulu Island was considered New Westminster. and them being added in was just strictly for numbers only. It really was not, it was considered because it was on Lulu Island, it was part of Richmond. But it really never has been. And I know that New West is at the tipping point of where they may need two ridings. And I think they should probably have a long, hard look at putting Queensborough back. And if you look at Queensborough on a map, you'll see that there actually is almost a physical divide between it and the rest of Richmond by Highway 91 and Queensborough Bridge, etc. it's actually not that easy to get to Richmond from there. So it's just, it is something that should be considered. Plus, it's a different school district, whereas the rest of the ridings in Richmond are all in the one school district. So, as I say, that just one thing that makes sense to me. And like I say, I've been in East Richmond for 40 years with a business. I live in another part of Richmond for 30 years. My other point, though, is professionally, I'm in wholesale and have traveled the entire province in sporting goods and promotional products. I've traveled the entire province for over 40 years, at least two or three times a year, depending on the area of the province. And when I was up north in October, I was extremely struck when I was talking to my customers and other individuals up there that we're about to have a population shift. And I'm worried that we're having a conversation about the Lower Mainland without taking into consideration that other part of it. For example, Prince Rupert, once they lost all their the Eurochem pulp mill and a few other things, they definitely had a population die. But they're right now bursting at the seams. They don't have enough housing just for the projects they've got going on. The port is expanding by two berths every 3 or 4 years. They've got a propane plant going in there. There's a few other items going in there. And they just don't have the housing in Prince Rupert. Now we go over to Terrace. Same situation. We've got what's going to be happening in Kitimat and Terrace with the new LNG plant, new jobs coming in, the new regional hospital that's in Terrace. Again, they have the same problem. They don't have enough housing. They don't have enough housing for the people they've got there now, let alone what's coming. So those communities are about to go into a huge growth spurt, which is not being talked about down here. I don't think people understand down here understand what is going on up there. Smithers, somewhat the same thing, but more in the tourism area. But again, there's growth spurts. There's been a lot of talk here about diversification, et cetera. The Aboriginal community is the fastest growing single segment of population in the province. While it's a smaller group, their percentage growth in terms of the population is higher. And that's an area where there's a lot of Indigenous populations, and they're growing, and they're going to need more facilities, et cetera, et cetera. One of the speakers here had made a point about that everybody's online, et cetera. That's not true. Up north, the smaller communities are still trying to get that bandwidth and get online. Now, I know both the federal and provincial governments are looking at that, and with that will come more growth for more people, because this is one of the things they've got in the Kootenays that they're addressing. Is there's a shift right now, is all that population that's gone into Kelowna, which you've probably been hearing about. There's a second shift happening from the younger people that have grown up in Kelowna and Vernon, and to a lesser extent Penticton, are now shifting towards the Kootenays because they still want that smaller town lifestyle and outdoor lifestyle, et cetera, and they can't afford the prices of the homes that have exploded in the Kelowna, Vernon, Penticton corridor. So I'm making this pitch as a Lower Mainlander, as somebody who, you know, lives here, but I've been up in that area and traveling it forever, and I can just see that right now the conversation that's happening down here isn't properly reflecting what you're probably going to hear up there. And basically what I'm saying is just leave the outside of the Lower Mainland ridings alone. The island's a different story. But just leave them the way they are, and because I think you're going to see a dramatic increase in population once the housing situation corrects itself in those areas, as more and more people find that the Lower Mainland is far too expensive to raise a family. That's all I could tell you. Thanks for your time, and I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Don. And yes, we look forward to our travels up north to the Kootenays and on the island, just to ensure that we're getting the perspectives of all British Columbians. So thank you very much. That's all the names that we have on our list at this moment in time. If you've been missed, or if you would, you've been thinking about it and you'd like to make a presentation, if you go down to your tool, your Zoom toolbar, and use that raise hand feature, we will add you. I'll just give a minute here to see if we have anybody that adds. And seeing none, we will now open up for any questions. If you have any particular question, we've had a number of questions so far, but they've all been just technical, which staff has been able to address. So there's no outstanding questions at this time, but if anybody has a question that you would like the commissioners to address to do with commission's operations, just use the Q&A on the Zoom toolbar and we'll see what we can answer. I see we have a question. The question is, are you intending to increase the number of provincial ridings in BC to 93 as permitted by recent legislation asked by Emmett Mark? And I'll just start answering and then the other commissioners may want to jump in. But at this point in time, we're in our preliminary stages. We know that we have authorization by legislation to go to 93, but we have not started to consider whether or not on how to deal with any potential additional ridings. And any other questions? If there's no other questions, we will be closing the meeting. So seeing none. Seeing none, I'll just say thank you very much for your presentations and input today. The audio recordings will be available on our website next week. If you have more information that you would like us to consider or know of others who would like to participate, our website is definitely the best place to do that. That's at www.bcebc.ca. Once more, thank you very much for making our first virtual meeting a success, and we really appreciate the time that everybody did take in attending today. Sorry, I just realized that there's another question that came up. I'll just quickly ask it, and maybe the question is, why aren't the boundaries redrawn at random by a computer for every election? And the legislation, the Electoral Boundaries Act, stipulates how the boundaries, the process for the boundaries, and the items to consider. I don't know if Chair Iyer, if you'd like to add anything to that answer.
No, I think that's a fair question, but the people that should be asked to or posed to our MLAs and not us, because it's they that determine the legislation that governs the electoral districting process. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. With that, we'll now call this meeting closed.